Welcome everyone to the Sufi Studies seminar series. I think it's a great way to start today with this social occasion while we're all in lockdown in our respective cities. Our speaker today is Professor Julian Milley from Monash University. Julian is currently the coordinator of the Indonesian Studies program at Monash, and probably most of you are familiar with his work on various dimensions of Islam in the Indonesian context. And to me, what makes Julian's work really stand out in the scholarships of both anthropology of Islam and Indonesian studies is its particular dimension on the embodied dimensions of Islam or Islamic life. There's a rich array of projects that he has worked on, including, among other things, other topics, Islamic preaching, and intercession ritual popular in West Java, commemoration of subnational Islamic legacies, and his current ongoing work on state-funded Islamic bureaucratic field in Indonesia. It's really hard for me to compress a research profile so rich in a few sentences, but I want to flag one particular book that Julian wrote, which is his latest monograph, Hearing Allah's Call, Preaching and Performance in Indonesian Islam, which came out in 2017 from Cornell University Press. And it's a really wonderful ethnography of Islamic preaching and everyday life in Indonesia. Today, Julian is presenting to us on the Sundanese Muslim cleric and mystic Hassan Mustafa. And following his presentation, we'll hear a 10-minute response from Aidoan, and we'll then have the floor for discussion. So Julian, the floor is yours for now, and thanks so much for bringing us together this morning.
Thanks so much, Banu, for the introduction, and thank you everybody for coming to listen, and thank you especially to Aidovan, who's been such a fantastic colleague and influence in our university for quite a few years now, and this is a very special forum, so thanks, Aidovan. I feel honoured to be able to speak in it. I've got a bit of a paddle pop here, so I'll put that one up and we'll see if that can so I hope people can see a whole mass of writing there. I'm going to be talking a bit about Hassan Mustafa, who passed away in 1930. He lived during the colonial period. Contemporary Indonesia emerged in 1945 after the independence struggle. And this man lived under the colonial period. And there's a bit of a backstory here. So here's the geography that we're dealing with here. You'll see that the mustard colour is the contemporary Republic of Indonesia. And the area that, just a brief summary, I hope you can see my cursor here, that this is the Straits of Malacca here. And of course, this is a sea route between, well, India and the Arab world. And over here we have China on this side. So there was massive traffic through here very, very soon. And, you know, during the Prophet's time, probably there was traffic from the Arab world through here. And there are litters of wrecks all through here that are being excavated of, for example, Indian ships crewed by Omanis and so on. And they give us a kind of context for the arrival of Islam. Probably in Aceh here was the earliest contact. The area that I'm really interested in is down around Jakarta in the Indonesian province named West Java. And Java Island is the most populous part of Indonesia. There's probably now maybe more than 110, 120 million people living on that island at the moment. Predominantly Sunni, there's a tiny Shia minority in Indonesia, but the tradition in Indonesia being Sunni. But of course, it's an extremely diverse Islamic, as an Islamic context, Indonesia is extremely diverse. So I'm really, as Banu said, I'm an anthropologist, so I've spent a lot of time doing participant observation, especially in ritual and other kinds of forms of participation. But I'm also an area studies person. And now I'm working in an area studies role at Monash. And in 2000, I started to study Sundanese language. And that, if there's one term that I would like you to take away from this meeting, it's Sundanese, because not many people know much about the subnational ethnicities, the subnational nations of Indonesia. Sundanese, the Sundanese are the second largest after the Javanese. Okay. So I started studying Sundanese, and that was where I was going to do my field work. And at that time, I became aware of Hasan Mustafa, who's regarded as the greatest Sundanese writer, and he's very strongly remembered in the Netherlands, which is where I did my PhD. So I went to West Java and I attended an intercession ritual for 14 months. And during that time, I kind of was confronted with this figure in his legacy in many ways. So just a bit of more background, there are currently about 34 million people who self-identify as Sundanese. So it's a massive population. And in popular memory, you probably know Sunda. Krakatoa that's part of the Sundanese land and Sundanese culture as well, cultural memory. And also for those who follow the arrival of, in inverted commas, so-called illegal arrivals in Australia, a lot of them come from the southern ports of West Java to Australia. So that's another reason for West Java being in the news. And the Muslim population amongst the Sundanese is very high, about 98%. The reason I put a question mark there is because traditional census in Indonesia haven't acknowledged the traditional indigenous religious and spiritual currents in Indonesia. So, but usually those people would identify as in the census as Muslim. The Christianization project made very shallow inroads in the Sundanese population. And this was the book that came out from the intercession ritual. But around that time, I noticed in the 2000s that young people seemed to be getting into Mustafa in very interesting ways. So they'd be wearing T-shirts with these kind of very attractive sort of charismatic stanzas on the T-shirts, or even just one line from a verse by Mustafa. And people were really, I think, becoming more appreciative of him. Of course, he wrote in Sundanese, mostly in Sundanese. So for the Sundanese nation, this was a kind of authentic and rather strange and attractive voice in religion and spirituality. And furthermore, Mustafa's name became to be cited more in contests about orthodoxy and about homogeneity, which is a big issue in the West Javanese population at the moment. Some people are concerned about kind of increasing homogeneity in public Islam. Mustafa's name is frequently cited as opponent of homogeneity. And this is because of unusual and idiosyncratic perspective that he brought to his teachings. So with a number of friends in West Java, we began to realise that we could do something, make some kind of public intervention around Mustafa. So Asep and Hawe and others, we got together, and over a very long period of time, we ended up producing this volume here, which includes chapters by seven Sundanese authors, including myself, and a translation of a major work by Mustafa. You can see we went for the Frank Sinatra style kind of image at the front there, which was from a magazine feature about Mustafa that had been produced in a popular magazine. So that indicated that this was a person who was being given new meanings in contemporary West Java. Some people didn't like the picture because, for one reason, the cigarette looks like a spliff. And, of course, other people thought that he never went to nightclubs and things like that, so this wasn't a proper picture. I'm going to talk about his life briefly because it's unavoidable in discussion of Mustafa. So as a young man, his parents sent him to Mecca for a very long time, in fact. What's his 12 or 13 years he spent in Mecca, and he became a very key player in the community, which is called the Jawa Colony in Mecca, of scholars from all parts of the Indies. It's incredible that this amazing diverse population of Indonesian students that formed in the 19th century in Mecca. And something happened during this time. He obviously achieved a great reputation as a teacher amongst these students, but also he had a meeting that determined the course of his life when he met this guy, Christian Snuchel-Kronje, who many of you would know as the Dutch Orientalist and colonial strategist, I guess would be the best word for him. So Mustafa met Snuchel-Kronje, though I guess they were a very similar age, had they were probably very sympathetic individuals. At that time, Snuchel-Kronje was a Muslim with the name of Abdul Ghaffar in Mecca. And some of you would know that he was eventually run out of Mecca when suspicion was created around this role. But he wrote his amazingly well-received two-volume work on Mecca, which was originally published in German, with these incredible photographs of the customs of local populations at that time. And Mustafa probably was influential in the inverted commas data collection for that book. So the relationship between Snuchel-Kronje and Mustafa really defined the rest of his life. So on Mustafa's return to the Indies, Snuchel-Kronje then arrived with his Meccan experience. Snuchel-Kronje arrived in the Indies as a servant of the Dutch government. Mustafa was his close assistant. So he traveled through Java for a couple of years where preparing reports for the Netherlands Indies government. And he arranged two marriages for Snuchel-Kronje to Sundanese women that are heavily criticized in Dutch society. So Snuchel-Kronje is quite fierce debates around Snuchel-Kronje in the Netherlands because he entered into these marriages which were unacceptable by Dutch standards at that time, and Snuchel-Kronje's subsequent behaviour raised question marks about the sincerity of these marriages. Mustafa was in the thick of it. Here is Snuchel-Kronje and one of his wives, Sankana, and the son Raden Yusuf. Now, the historical memory of Mustafa is really ambivalent, of course, because of this in contemporary Indonesia, that the Indonesian nation praises and commemorates and remembers those religious leaders who opposed Dutch colonialism, not those who supported it. And that's a big problematic in Hassan Mustafa commemorations in the present. And it kind of got worse in the sense that Snuchel-Kronje then recommended Mustafa to become the number one religious official in Aceh, a different ethnic group to the Sundanese, very distant from the Sundanese. Mustafa was already known there, but the Dutch were fighting a bitter war against an Achenese resistance movement. And Mustafa went to he's called by contemporary Sundanese as an informant colonial, so as a colonial informant. This was this terrible war that was fought there by the Dutch against Achenese population. And then in 1895, he took up a Qadi role in Bandung. And once again, Snuchel-Kronje was very influential in that appointment. And this is when he began the period of his life when he produced his mystical writings of just before 1900. Now, so we'll turn to these writings now. Now, I one of the things that I marvel about the seminar series that Eidevan has established, I get to hear his marvelous talks about the Sunni lineage, mystical lineages within Islam, and my knowledge about those is not totally strong. So I ask you to bear that in mind when I talk about Mustafa's work, and of course, I'd love to hear input from people about that. There's a basic grouping is that a lot of Mustafa's work is in traditions of Indonesian or Sundanese traditions of verse, which are very closely related to Javanese traditions. So the Java culture is a kind of much stronger cultural entity in Indonesia than the Sundanese. And the tradition of mystical verse is called the Suluk literature, which is a term I'm sure is familiar to many of you. And there are also prose works, but in my observation, most of these were not written in Mustafa's hand, but were written by people who spent time with him. He had two secretaries and he had a coterie that formed around him. And this is an urban coterie by this time of Mustafa's life, who then put into writing his ideas. And we don't have much knowledge about how that happened, but the prose works mostly were not put into writing by by Mustafa's own hand. So that's the kind of early division, and it does enable us to see Mustafa's character as a mystical poet, but also as a speaker, as a preacher, and a person whose presence was highly desired in gatherings in West Java. Now, I want to talk about one work which is called Gelaran Sasaka Dika Islaman, which is the teachings of our Islamic inheritance. I call it a major work because it's received the most attention from Sundanese. People talk about being inspired by it in the present. It's got a commentary written by a Sundanese scholar. And Hawe Setiawan and I translated this over a period of about, I guess it took us about 10 years. It was a very big work that we did, me traveling back and forth. And it's published, as I said, in Sundanese. So you have, it sets out the subject, the progressing through seven stages, and here they are written in the Sundanese forms of these words, but I'm sure you'll recognise them. But it's really one of the remarkable things about Mustafa is he's talking about the Sundanese life course, the reference to all kinds of cooking oils and the trees and the plants and the coconuts really make this a distinctively Sundanese work, and that's why he's really highly regarded in contemporary West Java. And the first three stages are this struggle. So the subject, under the influence of Uluhiya from the right, on the right side of the page, progresses through these stages, developing a subjectivity. And while on the left, the recalcitrant subject fails to progress. And this is described in a very accessible and at times humorous and witty way. The final four stages are more expositions, but at the same time, that clearly these are Mustafa's words, because it's a real roller coaster. At times it goes into kind of diversions that it's difficult to follow at times. So let's talk about the teachings a bit, because I think it's very important to contextualize Mustafa's mysticism in the kind of global context that we've been discussing in this seminar series. So this is just an example of the way that Mustafa's thinking materializes in imagery and metaphors that are derived from his own environment. So here we have these two metaphors. About one is to do with the coconut, the tree, not just the fruit, and the second is to do with palm sugar. And the palm sugar is an incredible product in Indonesia for its tree, its fruit, its nuts. It's just amazing the many usages that are made of the tree and the plant. And for Mustafa, this was material that he knew he could use to engage with people who mightn't have had the inclination or the knowledge to appreciate a more scholarly sort of mediation. So this is one of the more important aspects of Mustafa's mystical writings. The idea of this progress through the seven stages is transferred into the fruit of the coconut and the palm sugar. But at the same time, you could represent Mustafa's work in this way. And this is using a really recognizable lexicon of Sufism. Now, this diagram was made by one of Mustafa's followers. In fact, in the teachings of the inheritance, the work that I'm talking about now, this is represented as a building. So verbally, Mustafa represents this diagram as a building that he approached and walked into in a kind of dreamlike state. So, and this points our attention, of course, to a more recognisable global repertoire of Sufi concepts. So I want to talk a bit about that particular genealogy here. And when I was preparing the work, I was reading a bit of the work of Chittick, and at the general level, this quote, which seemed to me to be the most representative of what I was reading in Mustafa, this idea of the journey where a human acquires divine attributes which prepare him for acquiring more. This definitely, to me, sums up what Mustafa was, his basic idea in the seven stages here. And that makes sense because basic kalam, I mean, Sundanese students, even today, still today, they really engage with these teachings about the sifat, about the attributes. And this is basic learning. And people can memorize this stuff in verse forms, and they're taught them in verse forms that they memorize. So they know all about the attributes in some detail at this level of rote memorization. It makes perfect sense that Mustafa, I think, would use this lexicon to communicate with people in his environment. But nevertheless, there is an Indonesian language, that a lineage of what is commonly referred to the seven grades, or the seven martabat is the word that's, of course, used in Indonesian languages. And the literature about Indonesian mysticism points to the Gujarati scholar Muhammad ibn Fadlillah al-Burhanpuri as the main author. One of his works, At-Tufat al-Mursala ila Ruhin Nabi, which I, The Gift Addressed to the Spirit of the Prophet, has become very popular in Indonesia, largely through these networks in the peninsula, of course, these kind of works were brought back to Indonesia. And a noted teacher was Ibrahim al-Qurani, whose name I think I have mentioned with Adela in past discussions. And in fact, in 1665, al-Qurani's opinion was sought from by Indonesian, we call them Indonesian, but of course at that time they were, I guess, subjects of the populations of Netherlands Indies. They asked al-Qurani for guidance about some aspects of the atufa, of the gift addressed to the spirit of the prophet. So there was this quite a big dialogue going on between the centers of the Islamic world and this, in inverted commas, periphery for quite a long time. Shatari lineages are mentioned frequently in that, and that's interesting because there are similar. I'm not an expert in Shatari teachings, but the Shatari Tariqa has been very influential in the western part of Java. So the framework is there for the transmission of this kind of this mysticism historically, and this was really indigenized in an amazing way, especially in Javanese, in the Suluk literature that I talked about before. And Zoetmulder, in his famous study, kind of pointed out, referring to many works, Javanese works in the Suluk literature, that you can see that this comment here really replicates the Chittik statement that we saw before. And this is Sheikh Raga Yuni, who's a character in a Suluk literature, a teacher, who says, the ultimate truth of ngelmu, ilmu, to do ilmu is ngelmu, is this: the essence of God is our essence. God's attributes are our attributes, and God's names are our names. So once again, the human subject accumulates the divine essences and attributes according to this line of thinking. And Mustafa's work really is very rich in those kind of references here. In this quote here, I put I in inverted commas because Aing in Sundanese has a dual meaning. It means I and self, but it also refers to the ego, the Anania self. And in Mustafa's scheme, this was part of this accumulation of attributes and the pushing aside by divine attributes of human attributes across the seven stages. And of course, Mustafa, there were people who wanted to hold Mustafa to account for this. This is Sayyid Usman bin Yahya, a very prominent Batavian Sayyid scholar, who wrote letters to Mustafa asking him to explain certain of his ideas. The basic critique was, Mustafa, look, you confuse two things. You confuse what we call the Khalik with you confuse the creation with and the servant in awe of creation, okay, which I think is probably just a classic critique, Sunni critique of this kind of Sufi thinking. There's a confusion here. You've got to maintain a distinction between creator and created. You're blending them together, and I think this is probably the Wahdat al-Wujud teaching that's the primary objection to that. And this went international, with Mustafa being critiqued in an Egyptian newspaper for being a servant of the colonial system, who was teaching false teachings in order to to weaken the resolve of the indigenous population. So there's a very strong accusations brought against Mustafa, but you can see that historical commemoration is really mixed about Mustafa. The second controversy that, and this is my final point here, the second controversy that Mustafa was brought into was about the theosophy. So in Bandung at the beginning of the 20th century, now Bandung was a colonial centre because of its emerging commercial importance. And of course, there are a lot of Dutch and German people there who really wanted to, who were on this exploratory kind of trajectory in their spiritual life, and they were very interested in theosophy. And there were theosophy groups that met in Bandung. Wangsa Atmaja, who was Mustafa's greatest admirer and scribe, who put a lot of Mustafa's works into writing, was a key person in the theosophy circles. And this, in contemporary Bandung, there's a strong effort to submerge this aspect of Mustafa's work. And I do find that doing work in West Java, you are struck by this homogeneity, which works in two ways. Of course, it's strengthening and it has this binding capability in Sundanese society. At the same time, it has its exclusions. And the thought that Mustafa's work could have been intelligible or valued by theosophists is a very dangerous one. And for that reason, people don't want to open this up. People generally, especially those in the institutions of Islamic learning, don't really want to know about this part of Mustafa's life and work. But of course, it is fascinating because Mustafa's work was being published in forms that were technologically kind of advanced. They were circulated amongst populations in ways that the manuscript culture of Sundanese Islam, they're distinguished a bit. For that reason, so there are probably some more questions to be asked about whether the work I just described, the inheritance of our Islamic teachings, was one that was so widely circulated because theosophists were finding meaning in it. And I think that's about half an hour, Edovan. So I'll hand over to you now. Thank you very much.